Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. For those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to make making our lives happier, healthier, and more blessed. Now, if you can't listen live, all of our shows can be found at answers.network. And I'd really appreciate it if you could all do me a wonderful favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive influence on the world together. Now, have any of you ever wondered about talking with a higher power? Do you ask questions like, are we good or evil? Why do people suffer? Where did the world come from? Well, Rob in San Jose, California asked us, why does it seem like power, greed, and downright evil seem to be dominating the world? I'm a 36-year-old father of two children, ages 9 and 7. I try to keep them from the news channels, and yet they still hear things and ask questions like, why would God let all of these terrible things happen? I'm at a loss as to what to tell them. Well, joining us to answer these questions and more, our guest, Neil Donald Walsh, has written 40 books on contemporary spirituality and its practical application in everyday life, including his new book, God Talk, Experiences of Humanity's Connections with a Higher Power, one of many books in the Common Sentence series. Now, Neil is also the best-selling author of Conversations with God series, which 7 of the 9 books made the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, book 1 remained on that list for 134 weeks. Wow. His titles have been translated into 37 languages and have been read by millions of people around the world. Well, Neil, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. How may I serve the moment?
Well, I think, why don't we start with Rob in San Jose's questions? I think he had a very, very powerful question that I think many people are asking these days, and even his children are asking. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say two things. It's kind of a two-part answer, if I could be allowed to be indulgent in that. But the first part is that God does not allow these kinds of things. You know, why does God allow these things to occur? What's going on in the world today? It's not a question of God allowing. God chooses to grant to this species of sentient beings, and for that matter, to all sentient beings in the cosmos. There are other intelligent forms of life on elsewhere in the universe, as we are all suspicious and suspect is true. So, but God allows, you know, all sentient beings to create their own reality and then gives to those sentient beings the power and the ability. We call that power metaphysics, but the power of thought, if you please, to create our own future. So it's not that God allows these things to happen. God watches these things happen and gives permission to all the sentient beings in the cosmos to create the future that they choose. Now, why the answer to the larger question, why are we making those choices? Why is humanity, exactly. Why are we doing to each other that what we're doing to each other? My answer, because of course I asked God the same question, and my answer, the answer that I received in my conversations with God, is that we are doing these things because we don't know who we really are. We've never answered the fundamental question. There are several fundamental questions that most people have not really taken a serious look at or sought the answers to in a very in-depth way. The questions are, number one, who am I? Number two, where am I? Number three, that is, where and not what room am I in or what country do I live in, but, you know, where in the ultimate reality am I? Number three, why am I where I am? And then number four, What do I intend to do about that? Those four questions occurred to me, you know, whenever I look at the world. Wait a minute, what's going on here? But most people have never answered, and frankly, before I had my conversations with God, neither did I. I never sat down and thought to myself, okay, you know, who am I really? Who am I? But so let me give you my answers, if I might, very quickly to kind of set the stage.
Please.
For our further discussion. My answer to the question, who am I, is I'm not this. For a while, but for the first 50 years of my life, I thought I was this, that this is who I am. That is, I am my body, or at the very least, I am my mind. And most people think that I'm both. I'm my body and my mind. This is who I am. But in fact, it turns out this is not who I am. These are simply tools, pieces of equipment, if you please, being used by who I really am. And who I really am is a spiritual entity. It turns out that I am a spiritual being that many religious denominations call a soul. I am a soul. And that's the answer to the question. Who am I? I am a spiritual entity. Question number two, where am I? I'm in the realm of the physical. I'm told that there are three realms in the kingdom of God, the realm of the spiritual, the realm of the physical, and the realm of pure being, which I'm told is the two other realms combined, or what we might call, if you please, paradise or nirvana or heaven. Question number three, why am I where I am? I'm in the realm of the spiritual when I am on what we call popularly the other side. But right now, I am in the realm of the physical. And why am I where I am? In order to give me an opportunity to complete the agenda of the soul. My understanding is, Alan, that the soul does have an agenda, and that my agenda is I've come to the realm of the physical in order to experience through the demonstration thereof who I really am. I want to experience not just that I'm a soul, that a spiritual entity, but what kind of a spiritual entity. I want to experience that I am what God said to me I am, which is, here it comes, be careful, an individuation of divinity. I am told that every soul in the cosmos is an individual expression of the divine. An individuation of divinity, and we come into the physical realm in order to experience that through the demonstration of it. Some people have actually done that, and we've listened to them and heard what they've said, and their movement through life as a conscious demonstration of divinity has changed the world in many, many powerful, positive, and important ways. Question number four, what do I intend to do about that? The way I'm living my life is my answer to that question. I am answering the question every moment of my life, even as I'm doing right now on this program with you, Alan. So what do I intend to do about that? Watch me tomorrow.
Well, and I absolutely love that. I have, you know, I've said for many, many years, the same type of thing and did so with my own children was, to model what it is, what it is to be a godly person. And so I like that part.
Or as Gandhi is reputed to have said, be the change you wish to see in the world.
Yes. Yes. So, and again, I know that you have, I think, 40 books that you've written this young man, Rob. Are any of your books written for a younger audience? Again, he's talking about 9 and 7 are his kids. Is there one that's kind of ideal to be able to give them? Because, you know, even with the explanation that you gave, I think some of that might be a little difficult for a 7-year-old to grasp.
I've produced a children's book called The Little Soul and the Sun, which doesn't describe all that I've just shared with you here, but does lay the groundwork for movement into larger understandings as the child grows older. It's a wonderful children's book, if I say so myself. What makes it wonderful is that it was illustrated by a marvelous artist, And so it's a full color children's book, The Little Soul in the Sun, which describes how the soul is visited by another soul who allows it to understand some things about why there is bullying in the world and why certain things happen. And it's described at an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old level. And as I said, it serves as kind of a platform to move children into a larger exploration when they turn, 13, 14, 15 and move into their teenage years. Then I've written another book called Conversations with God for Teens. Book is written especially for teenagers. And how I accomplished that, frankly, was I put an invitation. This is now years ago. I put an invitation out on the internet, Alan, and I asked teenagers, if you could ever ask God any question in the world you'd like to ask, what would it be? And I was inundated, as you might imagine, with questions from teenagers, young people from the age of 13 to 18, sending me a slew of questions. And I put those questions to God in my conversations experience and put the answers that I received in the book, Conversations with God for Teens. So those are two books, one for young people, the ages 7, 8, and 9, and one for teenagers that address some of the topics that you and I have just covered here in this exchange with you.
Well, and thank you. I appreciate that again. So for Rob, the book is The Little Soul and the Sun. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the one for teens, can you give us that one again?
Conversations with God for Teens. Not a very imaginative title, but it's very descriptive. Okay. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah. No need to try to make it more complicated. Okay, so Conversations with God. So that's
for
great.
Teens.
And, yeah, for teens. And for everybody out there, if you're driving you want this, we'll put this in the show notes as well, or we'll give you a way to be able to get a hold of Neil and be able to get to his website, and you can see all of his books. In fact, let me just do that real quick. But we will also put this in the show notes as well. And that would be, website is neildonaldwalsh.com. And Neil is N-E-A-L-E, Donald, D-O-N-A-L-D, and Walsh, W-A-L-S-C-H.com. So you can go directly to the website and be able to to see all of his 40 books. But we have a lot of parents that listen to the show, and also parents of at-risk youth, because this show started out before we rebranded, was called Answers for the Family. And so we had a lot of parents looking for help. And I think that this is an excellent way for them to start having these conversations with their kids.
By the way, if I might interrupt, Alan,
please. Me,
there's also a third book for parents that's literally called Conversations with God for Parents.
Even better. I love it.
And so it offers parents some strategies, some topics, and some responses that they can utilize in their interactions with young people.
Well, again, I got to tell you, my brother mentioned, about the fact that you had 40 books and stuff. And I told him, I said, I just couldn't wait to get you on the show because there is so many things and so many people that we want to get messages out to. And so I love the fact that you covered all the bases. So let's talk about your most recent one, which is God Talk. And as I said, it's your 40th book. Tell us what makes God Talk special and different from your previous books.
Well, the first difference is that unlike all of the other books that have been published, I didn't seek a publisher. Most authors will tell you that, maybe they have an idea for a book, they write the book, and then they search for a publisher who would like to put it out there. Or if they're lucky enough to have a literary agent, the literary agent does what they call in the business, shops it around to see if any publishers want to put the book out. But in this case, for the first time in my life, my phone rang. Excuse me. And the phone was a publisher calling me. That's never happened before. And they said to me, Neil, would you be willing to publish a book, to write a book for us? I said, sure. What would you like me to do? They said, you know, we'd like you to write a book that explains to people how they can have their own conversation with God. I said, well, I'd be very happy to, you know, share the process that, you know, that I used in my life. I can't guarantee everyone that they will have the same experience, but I can certainly share how I got there in my own experience. They said, please do. So I did. So I wrote a book that includes 6 steps that I'm, you know, I didn't really, when I first had my conversation with God, I didn't sit down and have a 6-step process. I just kind of realized, looking back over my shoulder, at how it happened. Oh, I see how it happened. And then I made a note of that, because that's the most often asked question in my life. Whenever I give a talk anywhere or make an appearance someplace, inevitably somebody says, can we all have our own conversations with God? And if so, how? So I answered that question to the best of my ability in the book, God Talk. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think it makes it very special, because it gives people an insight into how they can have a more immediate and powerful communication with the divine.
And I know with the 6 steps, I know step 3, you define it as willingness. You know, explain what this means and what can people do to be willing, because I would imagine if they're trying to communicate, they think that they are willing. Is there something that they don't recognize that is keeping them from being willing?
Well, not everyone is kept from being willing, but those people who are kept from being willing to experience a conversation with God, or to call it what it is and recognize it for what it is, because, Alan, the world's 4,223 religions tell us, that is the largest number of those religions by far, tell us that, no, God doesn't communicate, come on, directly with you, maybe with the Pope, fair enough, or the chief ulama, or the head rabbi, or somebody in some position of, you know, authority, or holy person somewhere, but God doesn't communicate with the average human being. And furthermore, if you insist on telling people that God is talking directly to you and through you, you're committing blasphemy. You're committing heresy. You're committing apostasy. Alan, in some countries, apostasy is punishable by death.
I know.
So I know. Would that make a person unwilling to call what they're experiencing exactly what it is, or even to recognize it as that? No, there's enough fear-based religious instruction that stops many people from being willing. So willingness is step number 3 of the 6-step process. Step number 1 is possibility. We have to admit to the possibility that it even could happen, that there even, right, for that matter, is a God. Mm-hmm. Not everyone believes in God, although 85% of human beings do, according to recent surveys, believe in some sort of higher power. So we embrace the possibility that there, A, is a higher power, and that higher power, in fact, talks to human beings. Step number 2 is worthiness. Once we understand or embrace the notion that there is a God and that God does talk to people, ordinary human beings, step number 2 is, but am I worthy enough to be one of those people? Or do I have to, in fact, be, you know, on some huge spiritual path, or recognized by others as a holy man? Or, you know, what would cause me to be qualified to receive, you know, conversations with God? So worthiness is step number 2. Then willingness, which we've just explored. Those are the first 3 steps in the 6-step process that I wrote about in that book.
Well, let's touch on a couple of those, but actually before we do that, and again, I mentioned, I think before we went on the air, that I just came back. So last week I was at IRF, the International Religious Freedom Conference, that is set up right before the prayer breakfast. And when you just mentioned blasphemy, one of the things that we talked about, there was a gentleman that spoke about, in China, a person who decided to preach Christianity has been in jail now for 5 years for blasphemy. And they initially arrested his entire congregation, and then eventually released everybody except the pastor, and again, for blasphemy. Can we talk a little bit about if you're having these conversations, have you been led in one direction or another in regards to what religions are real and what religions are just something that somebody is, that man has created?
Yes, but not in the specific sense that I think your question involves. Okay. That is, God didn't say, here are the following five religions, that are the most accurate, and the rest are not. What I was told, because, again, I asked the same kind of question. I said, what am I to believe? There are 4,000 religions on the earth. By the way, not from the beginning of time. I mean, 4,000 religions being practiced today. 4,000 faith traditions being practiced by humanity on this day of our life. So how are we to know, which one is, the mm-hmm. truth, quote unquote? So, of course, I asked God. And the answer that I received was, all of the world's religions contain huge elements of truth, or they wouldn't have lasted as long as they've lasted. People are not, totally out of their minds. They understand. Mm-hmm. They recognize important information and truthful information and sacred information and helpful information when they receive it, which is why the 4,200 religions that exist have existed and continue to exist. But the challenge is not that the religions are not valid. The challenge is, and this is an eye-opener for me, God said to me, Neil, the problem is that the religions are simply incomplete. That is, there's more to be known on the subject. And the largest number of the world's great religions seem to assert that they have the full answer, that there's nothing more to know. They know all there is to know on the subject. So I have been invited to travel the world, which I've done. I've been to many, many nations, probably 35 or 40 different nations in the past 30 years, mm-hmm. asking a simple question, a daring question, but a simple one. Is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here about mm-hmm. God, about life, and about ourselves, and about each other, about the purpose of life? Is it possible that there's more information out there that we don't fully understand right now, we don't fully comprehend, the understanding of which would change everything? You know what's interesting, mm-hmm. Alan? In every other area of human endeavor, we've done something that we're reluctant to do in the area of religion. We've done it in science, we've mm-hmm. done it in medicine, we've done it in technology, but we refuse to do it when it comes to our most important beliefs. And that is, question the prior assumption.
Yes.
As soon as a scientist makes a discovery, the first thing she does is question the prior assumption. Fair mm-hmm. enough. Do I have all the information that there is to have on this particular topic? As soon as a medical researcher uncovers a new discovery for a healing of a new disease, the researcher says, it's time to question the prior assumption. Is there more to know on this right. subject? And the same thing is true in our technology. And that's why we've come up with miracles that we can hold in our hand these days, which 25 years ago would have been thought of as a miracle. Are you kidding mm-hmm. me? All the information in the world in the palm of my hand. Yep. So because we've been willing to question the prior assumption. Now, the issue here with regard to God and religion is, will religion allow us to question the prior assumption? Or is it possible that there's more to know, that there's more going on here than meets the eye, that we don't have every last bit of information? And if that's true, can we begin to search anew for what I call the missing death?
Well, first of all, yes, I think there's still plenty that we don't know. But right now what we're going to need to do is we're going to take a break. But when we come back, can you share one of your stories from the book, either yours personally or one of the other stories, so that people can sort of get a feel for how these conversations work for you?
I'd be happy to. But right now, this important message.
Yes, there we go. Thank you. And now this important message. Having a teenager at risk who is going through a traumatic experience can be difficult on parents, siblings, and all who are working with that young person. No family should have to go through this process alone. West Shield Adolescent Services is here to ensure you don't have to. Many of the psychologists and psychiatrists we work with have spoken about the stress families go through. Not just the young person, but the parents, needing to get their child to a program where they can get the help they need. West Shield aims to lessen that stress. Every case goes through a thorough intake process with one of our knowledgeable, compassionate intake coordinators. We want to know the likes, the dislikes, and the fears of each child. This important information is taken into consideration when choosing the best suited team member for each individual teenager. West Shield agents come from all different walks of life, giving us a diverse group of team members to ensure a personalized, compassionate experience for every teenager. This allows us to make certain every young person we work with gets to the chosen program in the best possible state of mind. We contacted over 600 of the youth we've worked with in the past to see where they're at now. 97% of these individuals told us how much their lives had improved, that they had better relationships with their friends and families, had gone on to marry, have kids, and were now using the skills they learned in their program to raise their own children. Our role of transporting at-risk teenagers is a vital step in the process of ensuring a youth's ability to thrive in their new environment, and is a role we don't take lightly. The recovery process can be a long one, but like any journey, it started with a single step. All right, we're back. You're watching or listening.
Alan, I got to interrupt you before you go any further. That was a fabulous informational.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Come on, guys. I don't know how to contact the West Shield people, but whatever they're doing, God bless you. God bless you for even existing, much less doing what you're doing. And God bless you, Alan, for putting that spot on the program. Wow.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. I think when we left, we talked about sharing some of the stories from the book. So, for those that haven't read the book, you know, these are true stories.
Let me explain, you know, what you're talking about so people know, because initially the book was supposed to be just about my life and what I've experienced, but the publisher had a bright idea. They put on the internet an invitation saying mm-hmm. to people everywhere, if you feel that you've experienced as well an intervention of the divine in your life, then mm-hmm. that's your story. And they told me that they got hundreds and hundreds of stories from people. They took the 6 or 8 best ones and put them in the book for a demonstration. They wanted people to understand this is not just about Neil Donald Walsh. He's not one guy who is experiencing conversations with God or interventions from the divine. People all over the world are having these same kinds of experiences. And here are 7 examples from other people. So that's why the book contains those stories. A mother whose answers came through the vision of her own child, a woman mm-hmm. who was assured that her health condition would be healed, a single mom whose message reaffirmed her belief that God heard her prayers, a scientist. One of the stories is from a scientist whose conversations with the God dramatically changed his entire life. So you know, I don't want to give away the punchlines of those stories, but when you read them, you're caught up in, oh, I see, it's happening to all of us. And I want to make the point here, if I can, Alan, that I make in the book. The point that I make in the book, and that the publishers made as well, is that all of us are having conversations with God all the time. We're simply calling them something else because we don't want to be ridiculed or marginalized or accused of blasphemy or heresy. So to avoid all of that negative response from a culture which is predisposed to deny that God is talking directly to us, in order to avoid all of that criticism, We call our conversations with God something else. You know, an epiphany, a sudden insight, a stroke of genius, women's intuition, you know, whatever we can get away with, whatever label we can throw on the same exact experience, which is when a piece of wisdom comes to us and through us from a source seemingly outside of us, something we hadn't thought about before that makes us, you know, slap our palm to our forehead, of course. And we say to ourselves, of course, there's the solution, there's the answer, there's the information that I needed. So I want to suggest, as I was told in my own conversation with God, I asked God about this, and she said, Neil, I'm talking to everybody all the time. I'm talking to everybody all the time. The question is not to whom does God talk. The question is, who listens?
I love that. Well, under the category of conversation, let's take this a little bit further. Because I know that in God Talk, I love the fact that you say we also have to start talking about God. So share with our audience why talking about God is also so important.
Yes, I'd be happy to, because you know, most people, again, here we go with our cultural bias. Most people in human culture have been told that there are two subjects that you don't bring up in polite company: God and politics.
Politics, yeah.
Don't talk about religion or politics in polite company. So we've been told, really taught, to avoid the two most important topics of the human experience when we're having important conversations or meaningful conversations, even casual conversations with people that are important to us, our friends, our family, our loved ones. Not supposed to talk with our friends, family, and loved ones about the most important topic we could possibly explore, which is another part of the answer to the question that opened this program. Why is the world the way it is? Mm-hmm. We simply refuse to talk about why it is the way it is. And one of the reasons that it is the way it is has to do with our beliefs and our understandings about God. The largest number of people who believe in a higher power, and that's 85% of us, according to recent surveys, by the way, believe in some kind of higher power. But the largest number of people who believe in a higher power believe that God is judgmental, condemning, and punishing. Loving, for sure. They will tell you that, yes, God is love. God is a loving entity. But that God is also judgmental, condemning, and punishing. Now, if we don't do what it is that God demands, what it is that God needs us to do, what it is that God requires of us, and so this is the teaching. Now, what's interesting about that is that religion also teaches us that we are at our best when we are imitating the divine. Be with others as God is with us. Which we assume means loving, but we also have decided that since God is judgmental, condemning, and punishing with us, it makes perfect sense for us to be judgmental, condemning, and punishing with each other. Now, if we changed our idea about God, if it turns out that that's not really valid, that that is inaccurate, that God is not judgmental, condemning, and punishing with us, mm-hmm. then our whole rationale for acting that way with others, our whole justification dissolves, disappears, and goes away. So there's a book called The God Solution, mm-hmm. which produces a solution to this dilemma, which is to redefine God, to establish a new way of understanding who and what the divine is. And the God Solution suggests that the God should be redefined in two words.
Okay.
Pure love. Now, when I share that information in a lecture, Alan, somebody in the back of the room inevitably gets up and says, oh, Neil, come on. We've been listening to you for 20 minutes for you to tell us that the big revelation is that God is love. Everyone knows that God is love. Even the religions have dogmatic differences agree that God is love. And I have to say to my friend in the back of the room, whoa, 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 relax. I didn't say that. I said God is pure love. Now my friend will say, okay, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that pure love needs, expects, requires, and demands. You ready for this? Nothing in return. We can't even love the person on the pillow next to us that way, much less embrace a God who loves us that way. But once we get to a place where we understand what pure love really is, when we can turn to that person on the pillow next to us and say, you know what? I don't love you for what I can get out of you. I don't love you for what comes to me from you or through you. I love you without needing, requiring, expecting, or even hoping for anything in return. If I'm loving you to get a return from you, then it's transactional. And suddenly I'm loving myself through you. But if I love you without needing anything back from you whatsoever, simply because I see the magnificence, the glory, and the wonder of who you are, as we would love a 2-year-old child, yeah, or a 6-day-old baby, needing nothing in return. God sees us, if you please, mm-hmm, as the babies of the universe. We are still highly unevolved, still acting primitively. And so God needs, requires, demands nothing from us. That would change the way we interact with each other and, yep, alter the entire philosophic structure of the human species. I call it the God solution.
Yeah. And from your lips, if we can get this information out to as many people as possible, I couldn't agree more. And again, those negative things that people have out there, you know, I think that they need to understand that's a human concept. You know, that is humans that have said that. So I agree with you completely, and I love the message, and I hope we can get it to everybody.
By the way, a way to do that, if anyone would like a copy of The God Solution, which is a book that I actually wrote, okay, if you'd like a manuscript copy, I can't send you the hard copy of the book, but I'll be glad to download, or if you please upload a copy to your computer at no cost, just send me a note. Say neil@neildonaldwalsh.com. Please upload me a copy of your manuscript, and I'll upload a copy of the author's manuscript absolutely free of charge because I want you to read this book. I don't even need you to believe it. I'm not trying to convince you of anything, but at least open your mind to the possibility that there may be something we don't fully understand here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, for anybody out there, if you're driving or something, don't worry. We will put that information, again, in the show notes as well so that you'll know how to get a hold of Neil. Neil, we've got three questions that have come in from the audience, and we've got about 12 minutes. So I'd like to be able to get through all three of them, so I'm giving you a fair warning. The first one reads, as an 18-year-old male, as an 18-year-old male that does not believe in God, how can this book help me? And this is from Matt in Burlington, Vermont.
It can help you to come to an awareness that there's more going on here than meets the eye. And that when you are aware that there's more going on, maybe your mind will be curious enough to know, what would that more be? And how can it serve me? It would help you to learn how to use the power of metaphysics. By the way, you don't even have to believe in God to believe in metaphysics, incidentally. Mm-hmm. You don't have to believe in the divine being. Metaphysics is simply an aspect of human reality. Every scientist agrees that there's a metaphysical power in the universe. So that's the answer to your question, that it will help you to expand your mind and possibly answer the question, how can I make my life better than it is? How do I get all the struggle, all the anger, all the frustration, all the disappointment out of my life, or at least deal with it in a way that makes it not nearly as debilitating as it has been so far?
Yeah, and if I can add a little bit to that, for anybody out there, okay, this book is not meant to convert anyone to any specific religion or a belief system, but I see it as just something that invites you to be open to the possibility that God is there to talk to you, and that you can talk back. And I think if you take that approach, you're not taking any risk. Neil, would you agree?
What have you got to lose? The answer is nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we have another one. This one reads, I'm a mother of a 16-year-old daughter who is struggling with her sexuality. I have many questions about how to navigate a conversation about God with her. The conversations she has with her friends are quite negative. How do you suggest I navigate this situation? This is from Jennifer in Madison, Wisconsin.
Offer her to read, or invite her to read, Conversations with God for teens. Mm-hmm. And tell her, it's not some author who wants you to understand something. This book was, all the questions in this book were written by people like you, written other by teenagers. Other teenagers from around the world sent in their most important questions. So you might find it at the very interesting to see what the other teenagers asked about and the kind of answers that have been given to them. That's what I would suggest as an opening, overture to her.
And I completely agree. And again, as someone who's worked with many parents that are dealing with teens that are going through stages, or they're having some issues, or whatever it may be, I've made the joke that we as the parent, when they're about that age, it's as if a giant needle comes out of the sky and sucks half our brain out, because all of a sudden we as the parents are not that smart. So if you can give them something to where they're getting it from another source, I think that's going to be something that's going to have a much better effect. And the good news to this is that, generally speaking, that 16-year-old, after they get to about 20, all of a sudden that needle comes back and gives us back all of our intelligence again, and all of a sudden we're pretty smart. So, but yes, if you can get this information from someone else, Jennifer, to your daughter, by getting the book, I think it's a great idea.
When I talk to young people, I often bring up something that intrigues them. Most young people between 16 and 20 have heard about a guy named Bill Shakespeare. Sure. Bill said this, which intrigues young people when I invite them to look deeply behind the statement. You may recall that it was Bill who wrote, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." What was he getting at? What was he getting at? Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to rise up against a sea of troubles, and by opposing to end them. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. Or in that sleep of death, what dreams may come. When I talk to young people about that, their ears open up, because they've heard most of those quotes somewhere between mm-hmm. the ages of 16 and 19, and they go, there are many, many people in many different ways, including the dramas of William Shakespeare, who was one of the great metaphysicians of all time, in my point of view. Mm-hmm. Many messages coming to us from many different sources. Just open your mind. Stop listening to other teenagers who are talking from a closed mind. Allow to the possibility that there's more going on here than meets the eye.
You know, I am synergizing with you so much. I love that, because you are telling them something that has been a message I've been trying to get out there for years, which is think for yourself. Don't allow yourself to be swayed by, in this day and age, by social media or network news or your friends or whatever. Think, learn, and discern what it is that you're hearing, and make your own decisions. And I love the fact that you use that quote to make them think. It's beautiful. Okay, we've got about 5 minutes, and we've got one more question, again, from a listener. This one reads, please explain evil to me. It appears as though many of those controlling powerful media are hell-bent on destroying people's hopes, dreams, and happiness. Are we being tested? Is it misery loves company? Is it hurt people? And how do you think we can reverse this trend? And this is from Donnell in Chicago, Illinois.
Again, our friend Bill wrote, nothing is evil, less thinking make it so. But what makes us call something evil when it is the opposite of what it is we choose and yearn to experience? And in conversations with God, we're told about the law of opposites. Okay. In the absence of what you are not, what you are is not. Let me give you an example. Metaphorically speaking, let's say I am the light. I consider myself to be the light. I'm just using a metaphor. Now, if I want to experience myself as the light, I have to do something most unusual, because right now I'm like a candle in the sun. I mean, I'm there all right, along with 50 kajillion other candles, but I can't experience or express myself as the light because I'm a candle in the sun. Now, the sun would not be the sun without one of its candles, but I want to experience myself as that. Therefore, I would have to move to a place where there is what I see, the darkness. Then I can experience and express myself as the light. Raise, therefore, not your fist to heaven, and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness, that you might know who you really are, and that all those whose lives you touch might know who they really are as well. What is evil? Evil is that which we have created of our own free will on this planet, our actions and our behaviors, which do not do good to anyone and actually harm other people. But they are actions that we can use to produce good in the world, because suddenly we have something against which to measure who we are and who we choose to be. Ah, here we go again with Bill. To be or not to be, that's the question. So, resist not evil, but that does not mean don't seek to change it. What you resist persists, but be the change you wish to see in the world. And suddenly you will find that the evil that you have discovered in the world has served you in a way that allowed you to move forward in the process that we call transformation of your own life, and for that matter, of the lives of other people whose lives you touch. You know, this is important, Alan. Let me yeah. conclude with this. I've been asked, what's the single most important question? Most important answer you ever received in conversations with God? And the answer is this. I said to God, what don't I understand that makes life work? And he said, Neil, it's very simple. Your life is not about you. You think your life is about you, but your life is not about you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. But when you realize that, you get in touch with a larger universal truth that in the universal sense, your life is about you for a most elegant reason. Mm-hmm. There's only one of us in the room. All things are one thing. There's only one thing, and all things are part of the one thing there is. Therefore, do unto others as you would have it done unto you, because it is being done unto you.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you were saying that, I got a vision of a man I just saw in an interview recently that was very touching. And he's a Palestinian man. And he said that he had been raised since he was a child to hate Jews, Americans, anybody other than themselves. And he said, and it was taught in the school and everything. And he said that he was sent away to school, and as he met other people, he would you know, they would tell him something or whatever, and he'd say, well, that's not how your kind acts. And then they'd say, how does our kind act? And he would explain what he had been taught. And they would say, and he said that they told him, they said, have we done any of this to you? And he said, well, no. And he said, the more people that he met, he then realized that his job was to model. He now, instead of hating, but he also wanted to model so that other people would see in him that the people that he grew up with, although they were told to hate, that he himself can change, meaning so can other people. And this was the vision that I was having. I was remembering this as you were telling me that, because that was what I was getting from it, is he didn't blame, he didn't attack, he didn't do anything.
And I think it's important to make a point here. This is not an issue or a problem only with Palestinian people. Palestinians are not, I want to make this very clear.
Yeah.
So no one thinks that we imagine that Palestinians are the people that are being taught to hate. People all over the world are being taught to dislike, if not taught to hate. Democrats, Republicans, gays and straights, men and women, conservatives and liberals. You know, stop it. It's not just Palestinians.
Exactly.
We have been raised to disagree with and sometimes to hate each other. Stop it.
Well, thank you. And actually, that's a great place for us to leave this. Which is, yes, stop it. And what I was going to add to what this man said was exactly what you said, was that it isn't just there, it is everywhere. And on Martin Luther King's birthday, when we did the show, that was one of the things that we touched on also, was for people to think, and that if anybody is telling you to hate, look deeply into it and find out what is in it for them, because there's nothing in it for you. So, I wish we had so much more time, but I would love to have you back. I think you are making such a positive difference in the world, and I so appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you, Alan. Those are sweet words to say, and I appreciate hearing those words and receiving that energy from you. It's been lovely to be here with you.
All right. Thank you. And for everybody, please be with us next week as we are joined by Talbot A. Stark. And he's going to be discussing his new book, Elite Performance for Managers. In this day and age when, there is a lot of people struggling financially, I've had a chance to not only meet Talbot, but also to read some of the parts of this book. It's a new book. It actually is released next week, I believe. And these are the things, these are the secrets that you can, and they're not really secrets, but these are the things that you can learn that is going to help you be able to be a great manager, which will take you into great heights in your own business world. And for everybody out there, please visit archives of past interviews. You can do this at Answers Network, or just subscribe to the show through whatever platform you listen to. Just remember, stop by one of our pages. It can be Instagram, Facebook, or X. Check out what we've got. If you like them, leave a review and spread the word. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.